All right, if you could please stand with me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand, just to recognize that this is one of the primary places that God encounters us. Again, starting in verse 20, working our way all the way through to verse 21 this morning. And God spoke all of these words: I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything. Anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below, you shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third, fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, your son, daughter, nor male, female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother so that you might live long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder or commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet anything, your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox, donkey, anything that belongs to your neighbor. When the people saw the thunder and the lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear and they stayed back. They stayed at a distance. And then they said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen. Don't have that God speak to us or we will die." So then Moses says to the people, these are stunning words, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear," or you could put there, "the awe of God will be with you to keep you from sinning." The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. These are the inspired words of God. You may be seated. A couple of weeks ago, I think we spent 2 weeks on this, talking about these words that show up 7 times in the book of Exodus that echo really down history, Western history, all sorts of people groups who have in their own ways experienced a sense of injustice, or they've drawn strength from these words, from all sorts of different sides of that. But often, and we said this a couple of weeks ago, often what is forgotten, because these words, everybody, even if you've never even read the Bible, probably have heard them, "Let my people go." Often what's forgotten is, for what reason? For what reason does God free his people? For what reason does he save them? So that, and repeatedly, over and over and over again, so that they might worship me, so that they might honor me, so that they might serve him, so that they might bring glory and honor to his name. That's sort of like the whole first part of the Exodus story, is this freedom for the sake of this God. But then the second part is the actual giving of his law, or we could say the giving of the sort of ways in which they can be free for him, the ways in which they can follow him, God's instructions for how they can be free to worship him. And famously, as you know, Exodus, just the chapter before this, Exodus 19, Moses goes up not only to encounter God there at Sinai, but also goes up there to receive these laws, to receive his commandments. And that whole idea, by the way, that God is the one who gives these, is odd. Like, there's not really an equivalent to this in the rest of the ancient world, that God is giving these laws, that God is giving these commandments. And it's not just odd, it's actually vital and revolutionary, because this means that the people, human beings, have been given their rights, and it's not just people, by the way, even the land, the creation itself, has been given rights, and none of these come by humans. None of these come by rulers, government officials. These rights don't come from people in power or authority. And this will get appealed to, by the way, later on in Western history and things like that down the line. But for our sake, I just want to focus on generally the law. And we could go one by one through the commandments. I'll just let you know, I took a full year of seminary course on just 10 commands, and so that might take a little bit, unless you want to do that for the next year. But I just want to focus generally on the law. And we should know that the law is far wider than what I can even do in one sermon. And it includes some judicial stuff, but it's not ever limited to just judicial kinds of things. The first five books of the entire Bible are in fact called law. And you're looking at the Hebrew word for that, Torah, which just generally means instruction. These are the directions. So literally, Genesis through Deuteronomy, these are all considered generally God's instruction or God's law, God's instruction. It's not just a list of personal, you shall not do this and you shall do this. That's not what his law is. It includes broader things. It includes, yes, broader things like justice. It includes things like worship. It includes things like purity codes, all of that. But it cannot be emphasized enough. I cannot exaggerate enough. God's law never brings about his people. God's law is never the foundation of their being or the foundation of why they are his people. What are the first words of the passage that we read this morning? The first words of the passage that we read this morning is, I am the Lord your God. Literally, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt and the land of slavery. God's people were never told, if you keep my commands, I'll save you. If you keep my commands, you'll be my people. If you keep my commands, I'll bring you out of Egypt. They already were his people. He already was their God, and he had already freed them in this way. Meaning, according to this story, rescue came before obedience. And sometimes we think as Christians that happened in the New Testament. Like the obedient stuff's all in the Old Testament and the saving stuff's all in the New Testament. No. This pattern can be found throughout the whole thing. Obedience comes after rescue, or another way to put that is let my people go comes way before thou shall not or even thou shall. Exodus comes before anything like Sinai in this way. And this is made clear over and over and over again, even in the chapter just before this in Exodus 19. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully, keep my law, keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be treasured, my treasured possession. So again, Exodus always came. God's saving always came before any obedience, before any response, before any law that was given at Sinai. But again, these instructions are not just things that individuals are supposed to do only, or individuals are only not supposed to do in this way. So it's not just a list of do's and don'ts. It was a way of life. There were practices, rhythms, habits, these kinds of things that nudge them towards God in ways that are unique, in a particular kind of way. Meaning the law was never given just once, like, you know, Amazon Prime delivery, these two tablets just show up to them just one time. That's the only time they ever receive them, and then they carry on. The law came with regular rituals, regular practices, regular habits, regular reenactments, even buildings. Even the architecture nudged them daily to do what? Daily to remember God's covenant with them. Even consider some of the commands that sort of inscribe this into their very life, to inscribe this very into their rhythms. Like, so for example, in Exodus 12, when you enter into the land that the Lord will give you, observe this ceremony, meaning observe the Passover and observe this remembering God's freeing you, and teach this to your children. That's not just like an afterthought, that's like in real time. Another one of these, when a king was to take the throne, so in Deuteronomy 17, when he takes that throne, the throne of his kingdom, he was to not only read the law, Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy, he was supposed to write it all down and to have a copy for himself so that he could remember these things. Even the law gets written into the land, like the physical material creation. We see this in Leviticus 25. The land is to have a year off. The land is to have Sabbath rest. So even that gets inscribed into the very material world that is this place, or even just the celebration through the singing that was done on a regular basis, Exodus 15, Deuteronomy 31 through 32, all the Psalms basically, but the Psalms that really hint on God's freeing them from the Exodus, Psalm 77, 78, 105, 107, 119, all of this, these practices, these rituals, these rhythms, these habits, engaged everything. It engaged their senses, it engaged their imagination, it engaged their emotions, it engaged their time, their intellect, concerning what? God's freeing them. God's ways as well, at every level. At every level of the individual, at every level of the community, at every level of the society. Similarly, the laws got remembered over and over and over again. Laws that reinforce certain social behaviors, certain social contracts that are necessary for covenant keeping. We're talking like civility. We're talking like trustworthiness. We're talking like the commands that we just read, like you shouldn't covet the things of others. Well, also, we shouldn't just not murder people. We should promote life of other people and our neighbors. So civility, obedience, justice, and none of these are by accident. They're all baked in, and they happen to be the very necessary things that make up a strong and sustainable community and a strong and sustainable nation. Just think about it. Everywhere they looked, they were reminded of what? God's rescue, God's ways, God's rule, God's grace, his, again, rescue, making obedience the most plausible option. Following this God, the most plausible option. Thousands of nudges. It's similar to my children. My children love Wisconsin. They do. They say they're Wisconsin people, but they were never going to be Badger fans, ever. Why? Because they received thousands of nudges in a better direction. I played the fight song next to their crib the day they were born, nonstop, over and over and over again. It was drilled into them. This is the greatest fight song to have ever been written. We're struggling. I'm still basking in the glow of national titles. I'm just saying, my kids were never going to wear the color red. It wasn't going to happen. Thousands of nudges, rituals, going to the temple to worship, eating the foods on particular days, certain religious garbs that we were going to wear, seeing their dad freak out emotionally, telling them this is an important deal. There's no chance they were ever going to cheer for any Wisconsin sport team. You didn't have a choice either, because you also received thousands of nudges in a weird direction. Whereas the West today has created the exact opposite, where distrust in God is the most plausible option. Disobedience to God is the most plausible option. Disbelief is the most plausible option. It's the most natural. This is often, by the way, some of you know this, but this is often called secularization. How many of you have ever heard that term, secularization? I'm not talking here like secular music, Christian music. That's a whole other conversation. That's weird. But secularization is a very important word to understand if you belong to a church and if you're a Christian and trying to get a grasp on where we are at. We've been talking about this as a council for over a year at some level. But very briefly, it's the process by which all those nudges that used to point to God, all those practices, habits, religious institutions have literally lost their social significance and weight. Again, this doesn't mean people aren't interested in religion. This doesn't mean people aren't interested in spirituality. But that all of those practices, even the one you're in right now, have ceased to have any impact on the culture as a whole. This is the world, the land we live in. I don't just mean individually. We're not talking about on individuals. We're talking about on society as a whole. And the story goes something like this. So if you start back with the Hebrew people who had Torah, all the way up through basically Western Christianity. So we're talking like 1300, 1500, so the late medieval age. So we're, you know, so Sinai, all the way up to 1300, 1500, somewhere in there. The people couldn't understand themselves apart from God. They couldn't understand community apart from God. They couldn't understand their nation apart, or their kingdoms apart from God. It wouldn't have made sense to talk about, oh, I do this religious thing. That wouldn't have made any sense. Even politics couldn't be understood. Now, we mash those up in weird ways in our culture, but politics couldn't be understood apart from God either. Who was the king appointed by? God. And not only that, the king was a sliver, an image of their relationship with God as well. Or when they just looked around, they saw it everywhere. Little signs, right? Little nudges. They saw it in their jobs. They saw it in the hierarchy of those jobs. The authority that was over them, they saw it there. They saw it in the seed time, the planting time, the harvest time, the gathering times. They saw it in the architecture at the center of their town. If they were in a little town, it would have been the synagogue. If they were in the city of Jerusalem, it would have been the temple. If you were in Western Europe, it would have been the most imposing building at the center of any town was the cathedral, church. Nothing in their life made sense apart from God. And by the way, that wasn't like a heroic sort of thing. They didn't come to that, like, it wasn't a heroic conclusion they came to by like weighing like the existence of God and these sort of philosophical arguments. They got there through thousands of nudges. It was the result of thousands of nudges because God was literally involved in every aspect of life, all the way down to the building at the center of the city. But then roughly, no one has the exact date because we're talking about wide swaths of history, but roughly from that late medieval age all the way up to about the 1800s, the West started living a double life. They split these things in two. So now over here, you have this religious thing that we do and these prayers, we go to this church, and over here we have a life that we live that God has nothing to do with. He's not even really a part of it. And then we go do this religious thing, we do that. Within that are the seeds of its own destruction, by the way, all the way up until basically the crumbling of Christian Europe, basically crumbling. And at some point in the 20th century, as Nietzsche once put it, God died. He wasn't a part of the rest of life anymore. And by the way, that's not just true for people outside of the church. That's how many Christians live their lives. And then they're reminded again when we sing some songs and we open our Bible, but we live our lives as if God is not even with us. We live our lives as if God isn't a part of the things that we do. We have this life over here, and then we have our church stuff and some volunteer stuff, but that's how we live. So this isn't just non-church people. This is all of us, including myself. Today, the nudge and the weight and the burden is on us to find our own meaning now. Because if God's dead, we have to find some significance. So we find significance, own meaning. We wake up every morning. We have some choices to make. The first choice when we get up is whether I pick up my phone. Actually, you don't have a choice. You just do that. The next choice, though, is what am I going to put on? Some of us take a little bit longer than others to choose that. And then am I going to put something in my body? Am I going to eat something? And then am I going to use that body before I go to work or after I go to work? And then I'm going to get into the car of my choosing, and then maybe I listen to something, so I'm going to use the app of my choosing, or maybe a streaming service of my choosing, and I'm going to go to the job of my choosing, and then when I'm at that job, I might even take a break to have coffee or lunch, and if you're really lucky, you get to choose when you get to do that as well. And then after that job of my own choosing, I'm going to then go home, and or maybe before I go home, I might go to a few stores of my choosing, a couple errands. Maybe I'll go to the grocery store of my choosing and pick up a couple things of my choosing. Then I'm going to get home, make dinner of my own choosing, and then after that dinner, I'm going to decide, right, what am I going to do with my time? I get to choose what I get to do with my time, so I'm going to decide whether I'm going to binge watch a couple shows, or I'm going to choose to maybe binge read a couple books that I've been trying. But my time is mine to exert my own choice. And then I'll choose when I want to go to bed, which then begs the question, where does the God of the Bible fit into any of that? Can't even understand politics anymore, either. We live in a, without God, that is, or with God. We live in a democracy. I believe that's a good thing, but that means we all get to vote. Yet the most common image of God in the Bible is what? King. You don't get to vote for a king. I don't get to vote for a king. So even the language of who God is, king, doesn't make sense. It's like old style language. We might use it now and again for special people from Akron, Ohio. But for the most part, we don't even resonate with the language of God as king. Even the idea of God being involved in history, directing things, right? Now we're doom scrolling on our phone. We see missiles coming from Iran towards Israel. We see Israel and the war in Gaza. And then we see all this conflict with Russia and Ukraine and then all the other conflicts around the world. And then we got the vote thing happening. And then all in this, we resist, everything in us resists the idea that God is actually in charge of world history. So now everywhere we look, literally, everywhere we look, thousands of nudges of a world without God, where I get to make my own choice and exact that choice on everything. And let's be honest, none of us here, including myself, like when people tell us what to do, this is true for all of us. We don't want our neighbor to tell us what to do. We don't want our spouse to tell us what to do. We don't want our boss to tell us what to do. We don't certainly want our kids, after we've had them, we've powdered their behinds, telling us what to do. And then we certainly don't want the government telling us what to do. And then you add to that all those beautiful political ads we're getting. How many like those? You're getting them in your box. Like, I'm just using this. I don't know. I'm using them as plates now, you know, making my food on them. We're getting these from all directions, right? And all of the messages say the same thing. They tell us every person in authority is either incompetent or corrupt. And then the question is, where does the God of the Bible fit into any of it? In the same way life without God seemed impossible, we live in a world where life with God is impossible. Doesn't make any sense. Those nudges, by the way, are woven into every aspect of our lives, every aspect of our rhythms, every aspect of our choices, even how we see our very own time and how we use that time. And so the law, the Torah, regular practices, some of these were daily, some of them were weekly, some of them were 7-yearly, some of them were 50-yearly in the case of Leviticus 25 and the year of Jubilee, they created and they pointed to a very different kind of world. A different kind of society, a different kind of community. Nudges of God's presence in literally every aspect of our lives. Regular times of production had them. Regular times of consumption had them. Regular times of planting, seeding, harvesting, transforming the very experience of time itself, how we saw time itself. The people of Israel, I find this fascinating. People of Israel, by the way, the king had one. People of Israel didn't have a copy of Torah. They didn't walk around like, hey, let's look at these laws. Let's read them together, guys. No, no, no. They didn't have them. They were built into all their practices. They were built into all their rhythms. They didn't have them laying around in synagogues like they have today. They lived and they breathed them. Patterns, rhythms, daily life, it dominated their social imaginations. By comparison, just using this as a comparison, we have vague, sporadic initiatives about our civic duties in this world. And they come to us in various forms. They'll come to us from local governments. They'll come to us from the larger government. They'll come to us even through nonprofits, even Christian organizations who want to inspire us towards our civic duties, our care for one another, our building up of community, and various other social contracts that we have. And they are all well-meaning attempts, but they don't work. They're of very little effect today. Why? Because we have billions of dollars that have been spent on thousands of other nudges. You know, I was looking up some of the older military ads, how service of the nation or any nation is a selfless act. One of the most popular ads that they ever produced, more closer to my generation, is now you can be all that you can be in the what? That's a very weird thing to say to someone who's about to lay their life down for someone else. Billions of advertising dollars, just as one example, are spent on little nudges, little messages communicating daily to us, delivered. My professor used to say there's a special place in hell for marketing divisions. Messages that tell us to do what? Well-researched, personalized, given to us in various forms. Usually they're expertly communicated and they teach us to do what? To be ourselves. Do the exact opposite, to enter into nonstop consumption, to enter into nonstop competition, to enter into nonstop pursuit of more, to enter into nonstop vanity, to enter into nonstop pleasure, to enter into nonstop recreation. One of the major off-roading vehicles for sale right now says, no restrictions on your life. Every aspect of our lives, we are told to do the exact opposite, to be freed from the very things that make up a strong society, a strong community, strong nation. The message, my friends, is the exact opposite of Torah, the law, God's message, which nudges us to do what? To remember his promise, to remember his rescue, to remember his exodus from slavery, ultimately but also to remind us of the very life that reflects that God who has saved us, which happens to also be the very things that make strong communities and strong nations. Would you please pray with me? God, these words, we throw them around. Freedom, liberty, release, grace. They're familiar, and so we say them glibly, we say them flippantly, or we fall often for imposter freedoms. In fact, God, we know a lot about unfreedom. We're too wounded, too obedient, too driven, too captivated, too fearful. So might you, in your ways, be our emancipation. And let us all be free at last, free at last. God of mercy, free at last, in you and through you. God, form us in your freedom, real freedom. And form us in your wholeness and gentleness. Transform our deformed, unfree lives towards obedience, which is our only freedom. Praise, which is our only poetry. And love, which is our only option. God, our confidence in you matches our need for you, and so we pray to you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and all of God's people say, Amen.